Hey, how's it going? If you're new here, welcome. Something Shifted is about identity after interruption. It's about who we become after a lifequake hits and the stories we tell ourselves when everything changes. And I think you're gonna like it here. My name is Sean, and this is Something Shifted. Today's story belongs to Harry.
I felt in my mind that 100% of these children would die if we tried this. The idea of anaesthetising someone, rendering them unconscious and putting them underwater for a three-hour journey in water that had literally zero visibility, high flow and a very tight and restrictive cave, how could you expect someone to survive?
That's next, right after this. If you're one of those people that believe rest is a luxury, we can't be friends. Real change is exhausting. And even when your mind is ready, your body has kept the score. It can't keep up without proper recovery. So I've started taking Solol's magnesium glycinate. It helps with muscle energy, nervous system support, and I'm honestly feeling a lot less fatigued. You can learn more about Solol and their full range of supplements for healthy aging on solol.com. solal.co.za. I know something true about every listener of this show. You're a survivor. Every day you've had on this giant rock hurtling through space, you've survived it. You've encountered risk every single day. Sometimes you've seen it coming, sometimes you haven't. But however you responded, it kept you alive. And here you are, a survivor. As a South African, you may well know that just being on the roads isn't safe. You probably don't think about it much, which is honestly a good thing, because if you stop to really look at the odds, you might never leave the house. Living is risky business.
I'm not a brave person by any stretch.
That's Richard Harris, or Harry, as he goes by. Even if you don't know his name, you'll know a part of his remarkable story.
People from across the world have been waiting for this particular day when we can say that 13 people from the Wild Boar Academy football team have been safely evacuated from the Tham Luang cave complex in Chiang Rai province, northern Thailand. 12 boys and their football coach who have been trapped inside the cave system.
Harry was instrumental in the rescue mission that saved those 12 boys and their soccer coach, trapped inside the Tham Luang cave in northern Thailand. Harry has skills, a very particular set of skills, built over a very long career. In 2018, he was an experienced anesthesiologist and a trained cave diver. Two things that, under most circumstances, you'd never need to be at the same time. And then a fun day out turned into a crisis in Thailand. So why would someone central to one of the most celebrated rescue missions in modern history insist that they're not brave?
Well, if the risk is personal, then I'm extraordinarily cautious and careful in my planning for the exploration dives that we've done, some of which have been very high risk. I've spent a long time putting every mitigation in place to reach the point where I feel that the risks are now acceptable to me, even though I'm, you know, my eyes are open enough to realise that they are still significant. You know, I've got a wife and three children. I certainly have not got a death wish, and I'm not a brave person by any stretch. I have no wish to court death. But when it has come to taking risks on behalf of my patients, which I essentially viewed these boys as, I feel that I am a bit bolder, not in a careless or callous way.
When you work in medicine, especially anesthesiology, you have to be comfortable with risk.
You know, this is part of my job. This is part of what I do for a living, is to look after people when they are potentially about to take their last breath. And having to intervene in those cases to give them an anaesthetic, intubate them, do certain procedures on them, you know, those interventions are very high risk in themselves in those settings. And so you have to be comfortable with the fact that the intervention you're about to inflict on your patient may actually be the thing that is their final event. It might be the thing that actually kills them, even though it's been done as a life-saving intervention. And so if you're not comfortable with that, you don't tend to work in that space in medicine for very long or not at all. So I think having done that for a long time in strange environments and in different countries has given me the ability to put that kind of risk aside and just get on with the job.
The experience in the Thai caves gave Harry a different perspective on what it takes to live a good life on this risky space rock called Earth. But before he found himself in northern Thailand, risking his own life to save 13 strangers, before he found himself confronting life and death decisions in an operating room, Harry had to save his own life. Something you should know about Harry and his particular set of skills is that once, when he was 15, he found himself stranded at sea, facing terrible odds. Harry had just completed a diving course, and they were diving a shipwreck on a summer afternoon in February off the coast of Adelaide. Harry, three new divers and their dive instructor, who was in his late 20s, were out in a boat.
The water was rough when we went out, possibly too rough to make it a sensible decision to go out, but regardless, we did.
This band of inexperienced divers were battling rough waves, trying to go along with the waves when the next wave hit, charging them in the back of the next, burying the nose of the boat and flipping it over, dumping all of them in the rough waters.
We managed to right the boat so that it floated the right way up in the water, but it was swamped.
Everything goes wrong. The engine wouldn't start. Their flares and radio were water damaged and useless. And they made the rookie mistake of throwing the anchor over the edge of the boat to stop them from drifting out, but hadn't secured it to the boat. So the anchor simply disappeared into the ocean. All they had were wetsuits and life jackets. Here's Harry recounting the story from his book, The Art of Risk.
We wouldn't drown, but that was the extent of our good luck. All we could do was cling to the boat and wait as darkness fell, the seas got rougher, and the temperature started to drop. I remember Sam, my friend, who was a little less naive than me, looking at the situation, the waves, the gathering gloom, the upturned boat, and then turning to me and stated that nobody was coming out to rescue us that night. A, it's getting dark, and B, it's bloody rough out here, and it's going to get worse. There are no boats that are going to be able to come out here and find us.
This reality was unacceptable to 15-year-old Harry. He was adamant that his parents would sound the alarm and help would soon be on its way.
As it turns out, we were both right. My mum was on the phone to the police, but nobody was coming to save us.
Well, not that night anyway.
Once the reality did sink in, it got dark and I realised, okay, my mate is right, no one's coming out. Then I did feel like I stepped up a little bit and my friend and I tried to help a lot with morale, you know, cracking jokes and singing songs and trying to get the girls, you know, keep them cheered up and so forth.
This rapidly became a lesson in keeping your wits about you and taking calculated risks. The skipper stepped up and emptied out the fuel cans, latching them onto the boat to improve buoyancy. And they spent the night drifting, in the dark, in great white shark territory, hungry and very, very cold. Until a local fisherman found them around 7:30 the next morning. At a young age, Harry learned that a good dose of realism is necessary to survive. We all do it, right? We stack the odds in our favor. Wear seatbelts, check the tire pressure, maybe stay off the roads on New Year's Eve. But we know, deep down, that there is no living without risk. And in 2018, when Harry got the call to join the rescue dive team in Thailand, he knew he would need to be very realistic about the risks involved.
The dive through to where the boys were is about 3 hours duration, and it was a difficult cave dive, not the worst I've ever done, but not without some danger. Normally you wouldn't dive into an actively flooding cave like this one. So we were very much aware of the hazards as we were moving through the cave, but I was relieved to find that we could get through to the children okay without any major troubles. My friend Craig Challen and myself swam in there the first day we were on site for two reasons. Firstly, to make sure that we were safe in the cave, to make sure that, you know, we could safely handle ourselves to get the 2.5 kilometres to where these boys were. But secondly, for me to look at the boys and the environment they were in and make some assessments, both on the suitability or health of the children for an anaesthetic, but also to see, you know, what the survivability of staying in that environment was.
Harry was there to assess the risk and possibility of a seemingly impossible mission. The international divers and rescue workers had weighed up all of the possible ways of getting the soccer team out of that cave. And, well, there were no options but to swim them out the way they went in. The boys were aged 11 to 17, and at this point malnourished and weak. And so the hypothetical idea, in order to get them out of the cave, they would need to be rendered unconscious for a 3-hour underwater swim, with divers needing to re-administer ketamine at intervals throughout the dive, in a flooded cave, in zero visibility. Yeah, that sounds extremely risky.
Yeah, I pretty much laughed and said that's a crazy idea and can't possibly be done. Rick Stanton, the British diver who made the suggestion to me, I know he's not crazy. I know he's a very practical and very tough guy. And I realised that things must be pretty desperate for him to raise an idea like that. And once I'd been on the ground there in Thailand for a short time, I realised that he was absolutely right. There was no other plan in place. However, I felt that I had more information at my fingertips, being a cave diver and an anaesthetist who's worked a little bit in difficult environmental situations with patients, but also having even practiced similar kind of rescues in our training for such events as someone who worked in cave rescue, to the point where I'd even pretended myself to be unconscious and worn similar equipment to what the boys were proposed to be dressed in. And I found that we just couldn't keep enough water out of the mask.
Let's just recap some of the details. The boys and their coach had been exploring the caves when the monsoons hit, and they got stranded inside the cave for 9 days before a team of international divers reached them. By the time Harry met up with them, they'd had some food and a little bit of comfort in the form of space blankets and medicine, but only for a few days. Four divers from the Thai Navy SEAL Regiment had stayed with the children, including a medic and a naval doctor. Harry made the 3-hour swim into the cave and surfaced into Chamber 9.
I remember the moment just before I surfaced in the final chamber, Chamber 9, which I knew would reveal these boys, and I saw the sort of shimmering of the water above me reflected in my light, and I had my first sort of moment of some anxiety, thinking, wow, this is it. You know, this whole thing is about to change from a hypothetical adventure to actually meeting these kids. And I was greatly relieved, actually, when I found these kids to be actually in pretty good shape. They were all walking and talking and their morale seemed excellent. They'd all lost a few kilos and they were only small to start with. But although they were thin, I was reassured by the sight of them. Yeah, a few of them did have chest infections and I could hear them coughing. Some of them had some skin infections and things. But of concern, I noticed that the environment was pretty unpleasant. Obviously, they'd been going to the toilet in there. The smell was overwhelming and there wasn't really anywhere to go and hide to do that. So, you know, it was only a matter of time before, you know, infections became a real problem.
The reality was that staying in the cave would most certainly result in death. The British rescue team had measured that the oxygen levels in the cave were deteriorating and heading below 15%. And on top of that, meteorologists had advised that the monsoon would return in 3 to 5 days, bringing with it more rain, more water, which would ultimately suspend all diving activities in the cave.
The idea of anaesthetizing someone, rendering them unconscious and putting them underwater for a 3-hour journey in water that had literally zero visibility, high flow and a very tight and restrictive cave, how could you expect someone to survive? I mean, in the operating theatre or even out in the field when you're giving someone an anaesthetic, whether it's because of a car crash or an illness or what have you, at least you have the benefit of modern monitoring, you know, a good assistant and illumination, to monitor someone underwater in the dark only by feel and sound, you know, doesn't sound like a recipe for success.
I think this might be the definition of being between a rock and a hard place. Option A is almost certain death, and option B is almost certain death. So Harry had swum to the cave and assessed the risk. Now he needed to make a very difficult decision during that 3-hour swim in the dark back to the outside world.
I sort of gave them my assurance we'd be back the next day and headed back out of the cave and got out at about 8 or 9 o'clock that evening. That was difficult, I think, swimming back out of the cave with my thoughts, thinking that I had perhaps over-promised and over-committed and was very likely to under-deliver now. And having actually met these kids and realised how extraordinary they were, you know, did very much influence my decision.
Once Harry surfaced on the other side, it was time to turn hypotheticals into plans. The American Air Force chaired the meetings, helping to coordinate the team of international divers and the Thai government make a decision. But there were only two options on the table. Option A, leave the kids and their coach in the cave. Or option B, mission impossible.
Of course, at some point, all eyes fell upon me and I was asked my opinion about what did I think the chances of this were succeeding.
Harry knew he was in Thailand to assess risks and make life or death decisions. He had known it the moment he left Australia. What he hadn't known, what none of the briefings or the logistics had prepared him for, was the courage and resilience he would find huddled together in that flooded cave. Would the children survive if they were anaesthetized and swum out by divers?
We do know historically that some people will not survive situations and they will perish before their substrate runs out, their oxygen or their food or their water. And the classic example is the lifeboat. You know, people cast adrift from their yacht when it sinks and there's half a dozen people in that lifeboat and some people seem to give up and perish before biological factors perhaps would really come into play. So what is it that makes some people survivors and some people not? And apparently you can almost predict the people in the lifeboat who will fall into each category by the way they behave early on. You know, the survivors are the people who might start to take stock or inventory and, make a plan for signalling a passing boat or how to catch water when it starts to rain or, take stock of a way to catch fish. Whereas the people who may not survive might be those people who immediately go into that negative mindset and woe is me and we're all going to die. And start saying that out aloud. So there's something psychological about survival as well as physical.
In total, the boys spent 17 days in that Thai cave. They were damp most of the time, cold all of the time, no food and only water in the cave to drink. And in the beginning, they didn't even know if anyone was looking for them.
You know, I do wonder whether some kids with lower morale or a lesser will to live might not have survived that. And I think there's a number of reasons behind their survival. And part of that is the fact that, you know, these were tough country kids who, you know, were used to a bit of hardship in life. Some of them were refugees from Myanmar who perhaps had faced some adversity in their life. They had an extraordinary man in the 25-year-old coach who was present with them, who was very important at maintaining morale and keeping them busy, both physically and with their minds, thinking about how to manage their resources in the cave, play games, and even to dig a tunnel towards the exit, which was, you know, obviously a futile exercise, a kilometer below ground, but still, it just, all those little things gave them hope and a reason to think they were not going to die, when really looking at it from a practical perspective, there was zero chance that anyone was ever going to find them, let alone rescue them.
So when Harry arrived in the cave for the first time to assess how impossible the impossible mission truly was, he was blown away by the team's resilience and courage. Harry then explained to the naval doctor, who'd been with the boys for a couple of days, a bullet point rundown of Mission Impossible, which had been written out by a Thai doctor back at the surface.
You know, one by one, they would come down to the water, sit on my lap, receive an injection into their thigh, which would be ketamine, the anesthetic drug. And then once they fell asleep, we would finish dressing them up in the diving equipment, which would include a full face mask. And then one British diver would take one boy all the way out of the cave, and that we would hope to do four boys each day. And then obviously we had one left over, and we'd pretty much think about that on the last day, how we were going to attack that problem. Again, relieved to see that the boys seemed to take all that discussion in their stride. No one freaked out or collapsed to the ground in tears. In fact, I was worried that the doctor hadn't really read out the message accurately, because they all just were nodding and going, yep, that all sounds fine.
That night, having surfaced from the cave, sitting in the rescue meeting in the early hours of the morning, all eyes were on Harry, who needed to make a decision.
I felt in my mind that 100% of these children would die if we tried this, even though I was really of a mind to give this a try. I still didn't believe it would work. And, people have asked me, why would you even consider it if you felt that you were essentially euthanizing the children? And it really came down to a very pragmatic and humane approach to the problem, in that, well, if they're going to die one of two ways, isn't it better to choose the way that is more pleasant and will return their bodies to their parents still looking like their sons, rather than waiting for several weeks or months to retrieve their skeletal remains from the cave? It also would mean that the Thai Navy SEALs would have a chance of coming out alive, because I was pretty sure that they would not leave the children under any circumstances, so they would probably perish alongside the kids. So it seemed sort of easy to justify in my mind that although the outcome would ultimately perhaps be the same, it was the better of two evils, and so therefore I had to play my part in it.
Through the expertise and the meticulous risk management of the team of experts, all 13 members of the Wild Boar Academy football team made it out of that Thai cave safely. One Thai Navy SEAL, Saman Kunan, sadly passed away during the preparation, 3 days before the rescue mission started. Most of us will never be stranded at sea, and I, for one, don't venture into caves, so that's not happening to me. Most of us lead safe, comfortable lives, and we try our best to create safe, comfortable lives for our children. But Harry's been sitting with a question for a long time now. What might we be losing in the safety and comfort of our modern lives?
The longer I spend on this planet, the more I feel that our modern lives are too safe for our well-being.
Obviously, that doesn't apply to everywhere in the world. But if you are listening to this podcast, chances are you have access to electricity, internet, and technology. And the chances are you're not trying to survive in a war zone. And Harry is not saying that trauma, with a capital T, is good for you. But when you become comfortable in a cushy lifestyle, small inconveniences may start to feel like danger.
The essential wild part of us is atrophying. Depression and anxiety are endemic in our society, including in our children. The jury is out on why this is, and I believe it's actually important for the human condition to still be exposed to some risk, an inoculation against hardship to make us stronger and more resilient. That, for me, is the big benefit of risk-taking activities. It actually encourages personal growth. You don't have to go out of your way to find it, but to say that you can have a life without risk is impossible, because more people die from, you know, cardiovascular disease or from alcohol-related disease or smoking or just from driving their car than they die from shark attacks or lightning strikes or falling off cliffs. So, you know, just don't engage with risk without giving it some thought is what I would encourage people to do. And the positive side of risk taking, you know, the health benefits and the psychological benefits are enormous and should not be underestimated. You know, what I've gone on to think about well-managed risk, well-managed adventuring that might deal out a modicum of suffering and a requirement to endure unpleasant things, which will ultimately make us more robust and resilient for the genuine challenges that come our way in life, whether it's you know, relationship or a health challenge or a career problem.
Calculated risks are needed to live a bold life.
It's a decision to do so. My friend Craig Challen is very famous for saying when he received an exploration award, he said 95% of being an explorer is just getting off the couch and doing it. It just starts with a thought bubble of, I wonder if I could do that, and then to actually turn that into positive action. And that's where it all begins.
Because life is risky business. There are no guarantees except that you will encounter hardships. Your children will encounter hardships. We cannot protect ourselves or our loved ones completely, but we can prepare ourselves by inoculating with a good dose of risk from time to time. And perhaps all that takes is learning early enough to just get on with the job.
Survived this incredible adventure. I had a great story to tell.
These days, Richard James Dunbar Harris, or Harry, is a retired anesthesiologist and serves as the Lieutenant Governor of South Australia. And if his story stays with you, and I suspect it will, look out for his books, Alfie the Kind, Alfie the Brave, Against All Odds, the Young Readers Edition, and of course, The Art of Risk that brought us together. Go on, subscribe to Something Shifted on your favorite listening platform now and never miss a human-centered story. You can find more episodes and ways to support the production of this podcast at somethingshifted.co.za. And because you've listened all the way to the end, we want to share our Something Shifted The Soundtrack playlist with you. It's a compilation of songs we've listened to while making this season of Something Shifted, songs that make us feel a little less lonely and a lot more empowered. The link is in the show notes. Enjoy. Many thanks to Rue, my executive producer, for additional writing on this episode. And as always, thank you for listening. Bye.